Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. The American people are fiercely competitive, a fact which some liberal educators and modernistic theologians have severely criticized. But competition can be good, or it can be bad, depending on the direction it takes. Our American competitive free enterprise system of economics has provided more goods and services for more people than any other economic system in the world. Technologically, the United States has surpassed any other nation, and to a great extent, the American success story is directly related to competition. Competition in every field, medicine, business, manufacturing, education, has contributed tremendously to our economic and professional success. On the other hand, we can become so competitive, so intent on winning, that we overlook compassion, honesty, justice, and goodness. Some businessmen and professional people are so determined to win that they trample on thousands of people, ignore the legitimate needs of our citizens, rape the earth's natural resources, and contaminate our atmosphere. For them, winning is not just the best thing in life. It is the only thing. Michael Milliken, the junk bond king, is one recent example of this almost total disregard for the welfare of others. Ivan Boesky is another example. These men thought that winning was so important that they were willing to engage in illegal and immoral activities. They both made and retained fortunes from their greed. Winning, whether in business, in sports, or in love, is very important. But it is not all there is to life. When we hear certain sports figures talk about their teams or their exploits, it is easy to get the impression that nothing matters but winning. It is not unusual to hear a coach or a player or a business tycoon say, "We are going to win whatever it takes." People with that attitude are likely to engage in underhanded, illegal, and unscrupulous behavior. In fact, our newspapers and magazines are full of the deeds of men and women who tried to win, and in many cases did, regardless of the cost. As valid and significant as competition is, should we not use the Bible as our guide in planning our winning strategies, whatever the activity? Should not Christians put God and family and country before winning? I'm not saying or even implying that Christians cannot win or should not try. But winning a ball game or a business contract is not so important as living by principles of righteousness. But can we win by observing Christian principles which are outlined in the Bible? Would it surprise you to learn that there are many who call themselves Christian who think you are bound to lose in life if you follow the teachings of Jesus Christ and of the apostles? Ted Turner called Christians losers. I'm not especially devoted to any sport, football, basketball, golf, hunting, or fishing, even though I owned and operated sporting goods stores for years. I never really became a dyed-in-the-wool fan of any sport. I do have favorite teams, such as the Big Orange, and generally read the newspaper to find out how my favorite teams are doing. But there is so much in life far more important to me than whether or not my favorite team wins its conference or its bowl game. I am not being critical of any kind of legitimate sport. But I am saying that sports activities are way down my list of priorities. But there are some sports figures, including some well-known coaches, who would do almost anything to win. Some teams violate NCAA regulations by improper recruiting of athletes, or by paying them on the side for their performance, or by other unsportsmanlike and immoral means. Bobby Knight, head basketball coach at the University of Indiana, has brought shame on his university and on the sport of basketball by his stupid behavior. I have seen him throw chairs on the gym floor when he did not like what the referees were doing. And apparently he does not like what they do much of the time. Most recently, he alienated a great number of fans when he yelled at his own son, pushed him into a chair, and appeared to kick his son on the shins. On December the 13th, 1993, the Tennessean reprinted an article by Pat Ford, staff writer on the Louisville Courier-Journal. The article had the title, "Yell, Scream, Kick Your Son, We Still Love You, Bobby." Bobby Knight had been suspended for one basketball game by the University of Indiana because he had yelled at the referees, at the fans, and had pushed his son and otherwise behaved abominably. When he returned to the basketball court, Ford reported that Knight was given an ovation from the fans, which was strong and standing. Please listen to a few brief excerpts from Pat Ford's article. "Great country. Great message. Here in America, if you win enough games, you can shove and kick whomever you want, including your son, and do it in public. If cheers before the championship game in the Indiana Classic said one thing, it was this: just win, baby, and we'll gladly take whatever baggage comes with it." Page 6C. Is that the kind of moral lessons great universities are supposed to send to our young people? Do we want them to learn that they are justified in doing whatever it takes to win, either in basketball or in life? Unfortunately, Bobby Knight and the University of Indiana fans are not the only ones who believe one should do whatever it takes to win. Many other colleges and high schools have demonstrated time after time that they are one with Bobby Knight. In too many academic institutions, the sports program is the tail which wags the dog. Sports activities become the school's reason for being. I know how valuable for a school and for community spirit sports can be, but I also know, as a former teacher, how disruptive of academic achievement they can be. Sports must be kept in the proper perspective, although I know how difficult that can be at times. From a purely technical viewpoint, Bobby Knight is probably one of the leading coaches of all time. But his temper tantrums, his abuse of players and of fans, and his behavior toward officials make a mockery of good sportsmanship and Christian moral values. Bobby Knight, Woody Hayes, Danny Ford, and Jackie Sherrill are a disgrace to college sports and to our great nation. These men and their shenanigans send a message to America's friends as well as to our enemies that we preach one doctrine and practice another. University administrators must not allow such abominable practices to continue. College and high school sports touch the lives of countless thousands of Americans, both young and old. But they do not have an effect on so many people as do our business and professional leaders. All of us have known business and professional people who have used every conceivable device to get to the top of the heap. They have lied, stolen, cheated, and even killed to achieve their goals. There is no point in denying the truth of this matter. John D. Rockefeller, Sr., a staunch evolutionist, did not believe that Christian ethics should govern business development. He believed in using whatever means were necessary to achieve his goals. He used the law and crooked lawyers to expand his business interests, regardless of the countless thousands of people who were hurt in the process. There is no way of estimating the number of people who were hurt by the evil plots and plans of John D. Rockefeller and his associates. Andrew Carnegie belonged in the same category. In modern times, he is best known for his generosity in endowing libraries throughout the United States. But he was a bitter enemy of New Testament Christianity, probably because its moral values ran contrary to his evolutionary views. his faith in the survival of the fittest, guided him in his dealings with his fellow men. He might have been ruthless even if he had not believed in Darwinian evolution. But evolution unquestionably had a direct bearing on his crooked dealings. Probably no businessman or politician embodies the win-at-any-cost attitude better than Joseph Kennedy Sr., the father of President John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy. The unscrupulous behavior of the Kennedy clan, especially John Kennedy, is chronicled in a new book, A Question of Character, A Life of John F. Kennedy, by Thomas C. Reeves. The book by Reeves is not yellow journalism, but a serious historical examination of the Kennedy dynasty. The book has the endorsement of Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post. It has the endorsement of the Los Angeles Times and many other reputable people and organizations. In fact, Jonathan Yardley calls it the best biography I read this year. It is a revisionist view of John F. Kennedy, from which his reputation is unlikely ever fully to recover. The Los Angeles Times says, "The John Kennedy who emerges from these pages was not a man of good moral character. He was reared not to be good, but to win." Thomas Reeves says that Joe Kennedy wanted to be a millionaire by the age of 35. By 1924, at age 35, Joe was a millionaire several times over. He was probably also involved in the illegal liquor trade during Prohibition. Gangster Doc Stacker, a lieutenant of arch-criminal Meyer Lansky, reported that Joe was involved in a hijacked whiskey shipment sent from Ireland to Boston in 1927. Pages 24 and 27. Reeves commented on the Kennedys' penchant for lechery, and then added, "In politics, they would do whatever it took to win." Page 31. Reeves also says, "Life for the Kennedys was primarily about getting what you want, about winning, no matter what the cost, no matter whom it hurt. Pious talk about integrity, humility, and love of one's neighbor was fine in the church, but it had little or nothing to do with the reality. And so, from their earliest days, the Kennedys were trained to compete, to be second to no one, and to allow no obstacle to stand in their way. The founding father, Joe Kennedy, thus commanded." Page 33. Thomas Reeves quotes from Richard J. Whalen's carefully researched biography of Joseph P. Kennedy, the founding father, as follows. "Joseph Kennedy was an unscrupulous manipulator, shamelessly willing to plot and spend in order to propel his son into the White House. Miraculously, he instilled into his children his belief in the innate distinction of the Kennedys and imposed on them the responsibility for fulfilling the design that he believed had been foreordained." Page 6. There is a question which seems especially pertinent to me. Since we spend weeks on television and in the print media eulogizing Kennedy every anniversary of his assassination, why do the media exalt John F. Kennedy? They cannot be ignorant of the illegal and immoral deals he arranged to get into the White House. They have to know about the dozens and dozens of young women he brought into his residences. They know he was guided and ruled by his father. Yet they treat him as if he were some kind of god, and his years in the White House as if they really did constitute Camelot. The influence of the Kennedy clan has been decidedly detrimental, morally, spiritually, politically, financially, and in every other way. Politics and politicians have for a long time been considered inherently rotten, although that need not be the case. The word politics comes from the Greek politeis, which means the science of good government. But in too many cases, politics deteriorates into using one's position to enrich his personal financial situation and that of his friends. the very mention of scoundrels like Lester Maddox of Georgia, Huey P. Long of Louisiana, Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, and Senator Ted Kennedy is enough to turn one's stomach. How does one explain the re-election of a Ted Kennedy or a Jerry Studs or a Bob Packwood? George Grant's 1991 book, The Quick and the Dead, tells the story of the development of RU486, the French abortion pill. The developer of the pill was Dr. Etienne Emile Bloom, a highly respected physician. Dr. Bloom engaged in an intense campaign to have his baby-killing pill approved by the government and accepted by the populace. He was bitterly critical of religious fundamentalists and right-wing Protestants and Catholics. Please listen to Dr. Bloom's pragmatic and unchristian philosophy. "I really do not see a division between politics, industry, and medicine. Each mechanism helps to contribute to the overall goal. Now please listen. I just do whatever it takes to win." Page 105. Were you listening carefully to that last statement by Dr. Bloom, "I just do whatever it takes to win"? That was also the philosophy of Hitler, of Stalin, of Idi Amin, of Pol Pot, and of other ruthless killers. In the long run, Dr. Bloom will probably succeed in killing more human beings than all of these other monsters combined. He just does whatever it takes to win. What an absolutely abominable philosophy. All of us have heard stories surrounding certain political figures, such as some I've already mentioned by name. Everybody laughs, although it is not a laughing matter, when more people vote than actually live in some precincts. We know that voting names on tombstones is a very serious matter. Voter fraud is a national disgrace, but it occurs in more elections, local, state, and national, than most of us could imagine. Such fraud weakens our democratic form of government and tends to destroy our moral values. It also keeps millions of Americans from going to the polls. Let me return briefly to Thomas C. Reeves' book, A Question of Character, A Life of John F. Kennedy. A few excerpts from this book will convince anyone who is open to being convinced that the Kennedys bought the presidency, that they intended to win, whatever the cost. In 1966, Richard Cardinal Cushing of Boston said to Hubert Humphrey, "I'll tell you who elected Jack Kennedy. It was his father, Joe, and me, right here in this room." The Cardinal explained that he and the ambassador, Joe Kennedy, had decided which Protestant minister should receive contributions of $100 to $500. Cushing smiled as he described the tactic. "It's good for the Lord. It's good for the church. It's good for the preacher. And it's good for the candidate." Page 165. "I guess I have problems figuring out how it is good for the Lord to have such an immoral man in the White House." Here is a revelation about the Kennedy clan, which ought to be very disturbing and disgusting to every American. FBI wiretaps later reveal large mafia donations to the Kennedy campaign in West Virginia, which were apparently disbursed by Frank Sinatra. The money was used to pay off key election officials. Paul Skinny D'Amato, an Atlantic City casino owner, and a Sam Giancana henchman distributed more than $50,000 to local sheriffs to get out the vote for Kennedy by any means possible. Page 166. The Kennedys, including John F. Kennedy, did not like Lyndon Johnson, but they thought they might need his influence to win the South. Reeves says the Kennedys made an arrangement with the convention chairman to gavel through a motion nominating Johnson by acclamation. When this was done, hundreds booed, but to no avail. Page 181. My friends, there are literally hundreds of other quotations from Reeves' book which show how immoral the Kennedys were and are. But let me read just one more statement from Reeves' book, A Question of Character. CBS News commentator Eric Severide called both candidates, that is Kennedy and Nixon, tidy, buttoned-down men, completely devoid of strong conviction and deep passions, with no commitment except personal advancement. Abe Fortas, a Johnson advisor and a future Supreme Court justice, said, "They're both hardworking, both intelligent, but I think neither has a core. I think there is nothing that either man would not compromise on to get the job." Severide and Fortas were exactly on target. Both candidates largely defined right and wrong by what scored at the ballot box and were devoted above all else to winning. Page 195. Obviously, we cannot go back and undo what the candidates and other crooked politicians have done. But can we not learn from their examples not to place such men and women in high positions? Should we not make a practice of voting for men and women who are committed to righteous principles? Any time we put a man in office who lies, deceives, commits adultery, and misleads us, we are sounding the death knell of our democratic system. Searching for and electing honest men and women to public office have never been easy. But we have no other choice if we want to preserve our freedom, our moral values, and our sanity. I plead with all of us not to be deceived by empty promises from politicians. But surely, churches would never be guilty of using pragmatic means of furthering their religious agendas. Or would they? Many of us, perhaps most of us, have come to expect sports, business, and politics to be dirty, although there is no reason why they ought to be that way. But those who claim to be Christians must never fall in with the fleeting fashions of this world, the literal meaning of Romans 12:2. The Scriptures make it very plain that God expects all of us, regardless of our professions, occupations, or avocations, to be honest, upright, and truthful. Please listen to these inspired statements. Paul told the Romans, "Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men." Romans 12:17. The apostle goes a step further in his admonition to the Corinthians. Providing honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. 2 Corinthians 8:21. Paul commanded the Ephesians, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needs." Ephesians 4:28. Scriptures like these can be multiplied by the hundreds, but these ought to be sufficient to show what our Heavenly Father expects of all men. He wants us to be honest, fair, and gracious. These passages are clear and powerful messages from God's holy book. Do you think some churches would do whatever it takes to win, regardless of what the Scriptures teach? Would church leaders ever have the attitudes of some business people, sports figures, and politicians that we are going to win regardless of the cost? If you believe that cannot happen, you're not keeping up with what has been taking place among various religious groups for centuries. Let me give you some illustrations of what I have in mind. There are cases where elders and other church leaders are so concerned about increasing the numbers who attend or about keeping those who attend that they demand that the preacher soft-pedal the gospel message. They generally do not come right out and say the preacher ought to be a little less demanding in his sermons. They gently remind the preacher how easy some people are to offend and suggest he be very careful in his presentations. Of course, there are church leaders who tell the preacher if he is going to preach on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, he ought to begin to look for a work somewhere else. Do you think I'm exaggerating? I assure you I'm not. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage are not the only topics which some elders and members find intolerable and offensive. If there are drinkers or adulterers or homosexuals in the congregation, we may be warned to go easy on these topics. After all, we would not want to damage anyone's self-esteem, would we? I once worked with a woman in a school setting who objected to my speaking out against the women's liberation movement, against abortion, and against other social evils. When I went to preach in a meeting recently where she was supposed to be attending, she asked the local preacher, "What social issues will he be discussing during this meeting?" Is it any wonder she has lost her son to agnosticism and unbelief? Some preachers are so determined to keep their positions that they are willing to sell their souls for a mess of pottage. The Apostle Peter mentioned Balaam, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. 2 Peter 2:15. Churches in our generation and in every generation do not need any Balaams. We desperately need some more Elijahs, Micaiahs, Jeremiahs, and Amoses. These great Old Testament prophets were faithful to their God, even when their lives were in danger. My friends, it does not make any difference about one's occupation or profession. One cannot use unchristian and illegal means to get what he wants. Whatever it takes to win is the way many, including some who call themselves Christians, choose to conduct their lives. Instead of guiding our practices by our principles, we arrange our principles to harmonize with our practices. This is pragmatism, pure and simple, and contrary to the will of God as revealed in the Bible. Like most human beings, I want to win, but not at any cost. I want to win in keeping with my calling and election as a child of the living God. My friends, we thank you for listening. If you have questions or comments, please get in touch with me. Thank you, and may God bless you.